Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Welcome once again, fellow journeyers, to the Gravity Commons Podcast. My name is Ben Sternke. I'm here with Christy Penley.
Hey.
And we decided that we would just secretly record an intro and not include Matt.
Don't tell Matt. This is
don't tell Matt
secret.
That we're doing this without him. We're just like, man, you know what we could use is a little intro, just the two of us.
I was done with his jokes.
She was, yeah. After his last dad joke, Christy was like, I'm through with this knucklehead. Let's cut him out. So he's cut out for now anyway. So... anyway, hey, it's September. This podcast is dropping the day after Labor Day, which means it's September. Christy, what are your favorite things about September?
I have so many favorite things, Ben. Okay, first of all, we have so many birthdays in my family.
Oh, yeah?
So my son London, he's going to turn 13. And my daughter's turning 16. Wow. And I'm turning 21. Okay, not really.
Wow, 21. Incredible. You can finally drink legally.
But we have a lot of birthdays. But I love fall. I love pumpkin spice flavoring and all the decorations and the leaves changing. Yeah. I just love fall. Yeah. What about you? Do you have a favorite thing in September?
I think September is my favorite month for many of the reasons that you listed. My birthday is in September.
Yay!
As well. And... it's kind of a milestone birthday for me this year. I'll be 50 years old.
Come on. Are you doing something big to celebrate?
Well, sort of. My son is getting married the day before my birthday.
Okay.
And so we're not really focused on, you know, my birthday this time around. We'll probably do some celebration later. Maybe just have a bunch of people over. But anyway, my son picked that day for, his wedding. And so that's what we'll be doing that weekend is celebrating his wedding. So that's
fun.
Another reason that I'll enjoy September.
Yeah.
It'll be my son's anniversary. I really love the weather cooling off. We've had a series of cooler days already here in Indianapolis. And I realize how refreshing it feels to me to have a day that only gets up to about 73. Versus a day that gets into the 90s. It just makes a big difference.
It does.
For my overall well-being. So those are a couple of reasons. I'm not super big into the pumpkin spice stuff, but I do love the fall.
Come on.
I love
flannel
the,
shirts. And like s'mores outside by the campfire.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things.
Campfires,
so
bonfires.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that. I started last night. Had a bonfire finally. Finally, the weather was cool enough. And I was just like, man, this is the life. We're doing it.
I have so many good memories of having bonfires and hay rides and apple cider. And it's like happy place.
It is. It's wonderful. Listener, I hope September has all kinds of blessings for you as well.
Yeah.
There's no clever pivot, but we're talking today, with Isaac Samuel Villegas. He served as the pastor of Chapel Hill Mennonite Fellowship for 16 years and served on the governing board of the North Carolina Council of Churches for over a decade. He writes regularly as a columnist for the Christian Century and Anabaptist World magazines, and his writing also appeared in many other publications, including Commonweal, Sojourners, and Faith and Leadership. Associated Press presented him with their first place award of excellence for theological writing in 2018, an award of merit in 2019, and the award for excellence for photography in 2019. This guy does it all.
Yeah, it does.
Today, Isaac joins us to discuss his project, Migrant God, A Christian Vision for Immigrant Justice. This was a delightful interview, listener, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you. Hey, Isaac, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks, Matt, for having me. Thanks, Ben. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Would you be willing to introduce yourself a bit to our audience? I know I read your bio and that kind of thing, but maybe like you do a great job of telling your story in the book and why your story makes this book matter to you in a particular unique way. Just tell us a bit about how, you know, being raised by immigrant parents and how that shaped your life and even your interest in writing a book like this.
I grew up in California, in Arizona. My dad is from Colombia. My mom from Costa Rica. Kind of grew up in, you know, Latino life in Southern California, LA, and then in Tucson, Arizona. Moved with the factory. My dad is a factory worker. So they're in Los Angeles, and then they moved to Tucson, the factory. So we moved with them. And yeah, so I mean, immigrant life, I mean, it was just my life. Like, it's not even like the immigrant's redundant. It's just like what, just how to think about our world together and what it means to build life. But I got more involved in, I don't know, in church organizing for immigrant justice and activism when I became a pastor, moved out here to North Carolina, pastored a church for 16 years. And yeah, like, when you're a pastor and people start experiencing La Migra, like the infringement immigration police pose on our lives, and you like care about neighbors, you have to do something. And so that got me involved, and me and our church involved in immigrant justice work. Yeah. And the book came from, basically the book is because I get pretty despairing about our world, and it's exhausting, doing all like immigrant justice work, organizing, activism. And in my midst of my own exhaustion and despair, I would kind of like run through in my mind stories of people that I've met along the way that embody hope, that like people who are doing something. And I would just replay their stories, like see their faces, remember them. And they helped give me strength to go on, help inspire my imagination. And I was just like, look, if these stories are so helpful for me in my head, maybe I'll put them out on a page and see if other people get inspired by them too. And so that's how the book came to be.
Yeah. I appreciate, Isaac, that, the way that you got into this work, you know, was not some sort of, you didn't watch a TikTok video and then, you know, like, you're like, man, this sounds like a great ideology for me to jump in. You know what I mean? It was just, it was your neighbors. It was people that you know, relationships with migrants and the stories that they carry. I like how in the intro of this book, you say that you're not trying to change minds, but you're trying to hold before us hope and possibility of wholeness and transformation among those who work for immigrant justice. I wonder if you can share, you mentioned wanting to share these stories. Is there a story or a situation or one of these relationships that epitomizes this hope for you? And could you share that with us?
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. You pick up on that point in the introduction. And, you know, what I was a very positive review I received in Christianity Today of the book, but there's this one line where the reviewer is like, Isaac says he's not giving arguments, but he really is. And I'm just like, you know, that's a good point. What I was trying to say is like, there's so many like helpful books out there that do like apologetics for immigration stuff. Yeah. And they do like all the Bible passages and say, my friend Karen Gonzalez, she wrote two great books about this. And you know, like you just kind of lay it all out, the cases and the Bible passage. And I'm like, I don't need to do that. It's already there. Instead, I'm going to do what I can do with like my own life and my own Christian witness and just share these stories, because I think they've inspired me and I hope they inspired others. And I guess storytelling is a kind of argument. So I should have owned that more. But yeah, I mean, stories that inspire, I mean, like, the book is basically those stories. And I mean, there is kind of an arc where I start with at the beginning, just kind of how bad things are. And I tell the story of Alvaro Enciso, who's a Colombian immigrant, US citizen now in Arizona. And for his spiritual practice, he goes out every week, once a week. And so he's an artist. And in his studio at home, he makes crosses made with found objects from the desert. So he'd go out in the desert and what border crossers would leave behind because, I don't know, they get caught and you drop a backpack or you die. And someone picks up the coroner's office picks up your remains, but your personal items stay out there. Or you're just like running from the border patrol and you have to drop stuff to run faster. And yeah, so he picks through all this stuff, like, you know, he'll find a picture in a wallet that somebody dropped in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, or glass from a bottle or rubber from a shoe. And he includes those on his cross as a kind of relic to honor the sacred life of these people. And then he goes out with these crosses, and the Pima County Coroner's Office or Medical Examiner's Office, they keep a GPS website database wherever people's remains were found. And so he goes out to those exact locations and plants a cross there with the person's name, if there is a name, or sometimes unidentified if there's not. And he just says all the different items, found objects on these crosses that are relics, they remember stories that we'll never know. They tell somebody's life in ways that are a mystery to us, but yet need to be honored. And that's, you know, that's one story that I inspires me at the very beginning of the book. And then, you know, at the end, in terms of the arc of the book, I tell a story of working in the Casa Migrante, which is a migrant shelter in Tijuana, Mexico. And it's operated by the Scalabrini priests. And I mean, this is an order. It's so interesting. This is an order started in the late 19th century. And their whole mission is to care for people on the move, like throughout the world. So they set up these houses, care for shelters. You know, like with Latin American liberation theology, the line from Gustavo Gutierrez onward is this kind of... like the poor is the focus, you know, it's the liberation of the poor, the preferential option of the poor. For them, for the Scalabrini, it's a preferential option for people on the move. So that's their focus. Hmm. So I stayed there and volunteered at their shelter, and I met this woman. She was from a Mayan community in Central America, very pregnant and on her way to try to cross the border. And it was remarkable to me that in the migrant shelter, these are people from everywhere, from like, you know, Syria to Ghana to Brazil, you know, just it's, everybody's waiting at the border there for an opportunity to cross. And they all threw her a baby shower. It was like the most beautiful thing in the world, where this woman with her unborn child in the face of an empire that doesn't want her or her unborn child. And like all these people who just met her that evening were like, hey, look, let's celebrate this life. Let's throw her a baby shower. And so there's like cupcakes and streamers. It was just absolutely beautiful. So all that to say, like, the book takes readers on a journey from just how despairing all of this is, yet people who are doing something like Alvaro, and then also the grace of people caring for themselves on the way. Like, people are taking care of each other. And that's out there, and that's God's grace. And I happen to get a glimpse of it. I imagine there's so many other stories like that that should give us hope.
Yeah.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life, so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Yeah, that's one of the, I think, beneficial or profound elements of your book is sort of the detail of the stories you share. Another part of this book is alluded to in the title, which is you're doing theology as well. Tell me about the phrase migrant God. And if some authors get to pick their titles, some titles are picked for them, but this could be the God who is a migrant or the God of the migrants. What are you trying to evoke and communicate with that phrase, migrant God?
Yeah, I picked this title. Well, I should say, maybe the Holy Spirit did. Let's maybe go that direction. Because this title came to me before the book. It was in a sermon I preached in 2011 at church. I was preaching on a psalm, and I can't remember which psalm it is. I mean, I should try to find it. But it's the psalm where God talks about the people of God as a vine that gets transplanted. And so the people of God is transplanted from one place to another, and that God goes with them. So it's like, you know, I transplant things at my house here, and it's, you know, always a little risky because where a plant lands, it's kind of like a good home for it, and it's a risk to like tear it out of that spot that it likes and see if it'll grow somewhere else. But so this sense of like God transplanting, caring for this community on the move to grow somewhere else is how the title came to me. But yeah, I mean, I think about the theology of it is at the end of the day, like migration is part of the people of God, part of our stories, the biblical story. I'm doing a talk at a conference tomorrow. And they wanted me to give like some more biblical engagement than I do in the book. And so I just came up with this outline of how the whole Bible is basically a migration story. So yes. The very beginning in Genesis, you have Adam and Eve. What happens to them? Well, God sends them away from their home on this migration journey east of Eden. So it starts off with migration. And then it ends at the very end of the Bible in the book of Revelation, where the heavenly city, the New Jerusalem, migrates from heaven to earth. And God is with God's people. God is. So it's this, it's bookended. The Bible is bookended with migration. So that's in one sense, it's like people of God on the move and then God moving with us. And then also thinking theologically about the way the incarnation is a migration story that, you know, as we used to sing in church growing up, I grew up pretty evangelical and we sang this song, you came from heaven to earth to show the way. I don't know what it is. You all remember this song. If that's in your...
Oh yeah.
Ben, how many times have you sang that song?
Oh, I tried to, I was a worship leader at a charismatic evangelical church for a long time. And, it was requested a lot and I resisted it. I just got tired of that song. Anyway, I know it's
exactly
bring
it
what
back,
you're talking
huh?
about.
Lord, I lift your name on high, right?
Yeah. That's yeah. Lord, I lift your name on high. I think that's what it was called. Yeah.
But anyhow, so I mean, it didn't dawn on me till now, but it's just like, as I was thinking more about the incarnation, I mean, that you came from heaven to earth to show us the way. I mean, it's all about God coming to earth in Jesus Christ. That's migration.
Right.
For God to be with us, God motivated by love to be as close to us as possible. So that's the dual. It's like migrant God is both like, God is a migrant in the incarnation in Jesus Christ. That's who God is. And at the same time, that we are people who migrate and God comes with us.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so much here. I wonder, you know, so much of what we hear about immigrants, migration, undocumented persons is filtered and selective, right? I think of Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent, about how the media sort of are the chaplains to sort of the dominant American narrative. I wonder if you can share some parts of the migrant experience that you have been close to or heard about that you think are out of the spotlight or underreported for most of us here in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, I would probably go back to that migrant shelter in Tijuana because I, you know, spent some time there and got to know folks. And there's a woman I met. She's Mexican from Sonora. She's from oh man, I can't remember what state right now. She's from in Mexico. Sinaloa. Sorry. She's from Sinaloa. And I was just talking with her and like, you know, people are very happy to share their story because they want it to get out. You know what I mean? Like exactly what you're saying. Like people don't hear their stories of their lives. And so she was telling me about how that week, she has a son who's 16 or 17. And that week, the local cartel, representatives of the cartel came to her home and said, hey, look, your son can either join our cartel, our gang, or he's going to die. And she's just like, what do you do? And so immediately the next day, she packs up all their things that they could carry, her and her husband and her kid, and start coming north. They have some family in Fresno, California that they were going to try to stay with. And so, I mean, I was just in my mind, just thinking through what it's like to move. Just, it's not a choice. You know what I mean? Like right. People talk about push-pull factors of migration. And so, you know, push factor might be you don't have a job. And so therefore you're economically, you know, the economic migrants is what, what's his name? Reagan talked about back in the day, yeah. Instead of acknowledging the fact that the U.S. was sponsoring all these wars in Central America, yeah. That he did not right. want to.
We caused this crisis.
Couldn't be Operation Condor and NAFTA. It has to just be.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just, you know, people or then pull factors like family members or a job or whatever. But like talking to her, it's just like, it's neither push pull. It's just survival. It's just like, you don't even have to make a decision, right? Like your kid is going to either like join this vicious gang in order to survive, or he's going to get killed. Like you don't, is it a decision? I don't even know what to call that. You just like fight for your life.
Anyhow,
so I was just so impressed with like her story and just like, I cannot imagine this world. And I imagine God is something like that too. Like that mother who is just like, hey, look, I'm going to like, I love you enough that I'm going to help support your life and care for you no matter what. And here we go. We're going to try to cross this border.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about, so our church, we're in Indiana. And very far away from where people typically think migration issues are brought to bear. But we, several years ago, partnered with a ministry on the border that connected us to asylum seekers who are in detention centers. And we sponsored them and basically paid their bond and took legal sort of responsibility for them. And they could live with us while their court case was ongoing. And one of our asylum seekers was from Cameroon, who had spent 6 months coming from a civil war in Cameroon where rebels showed up and said, you're going to fix our tanks. And then the government showed up and said, if you fix their tanks, we'll kill you. And then the rebels showed up and said, if you fix government tanks, we'll kill you. And it was a lose-lose. So same kind of situation you're talking about, Isaac. So he ends up getting mugged in Brazil and his documents were taken from him. And so he stands in line at a legal port of entry all day and presents himself for asylum, but because he doesn't have ID, he's legally marked as illegally trying to enter the country. And stories like that help awaken me, and I think others of us in our church and around the country, stories like that, we don't understand like what these terms mean, how the process works. We hear something like, well, they tried to enter illegally. And we think of, you know, we think of nefarious sometimes or wrong motives rather than a victim of the system.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the strengths of your book is that it humanizes the dramas that are happening as people migrate and what causes them to migrate. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about your local context there. I mean, a lot of the stories in your book come from like you mentioned, like Tijuana and other places, but we're in a new heightened, I guess you could say, era of ICE sort of crackdowns and detentions. What are you noticing locally and how does that intersect or amplify what you wrote about in this book? Maybe just share a bit on how you and those you work with are responding to the crisis there in Durham.
So yeah, thanks for that. That's, I would say that that's kind of like my biggest hope for the book. It's like, one, just to tell these stories out there, like to organize for hope. Like there are these shelters, people are doing God's work. You know, we should celebrate. We should say thank you. We should send them money. We need to get behind all of that. But also just to figure out how to organize points of care and resistance in the midst of this anti-immigrant society. And hopefully those stories, you know, it's not like there's no guide. I don't have a guidebook out there that says like what exactly to do. All I can say is like, hey, this is what we did. Here's some stories. Hopefully they can inspire your creativity in your own locations. So I'd say that's probably what I hope the book does to people. So for example, I tell the story of during the first Trump administration, our church offered protective sanctuary to an undocumented resident here in our community, Rosa. She lived at church for 2 years. We protected her. We arranged. So, I mean, during the first Trump administration, there was some acknowledgement that sanctuaries should be, or churches should be not trespassed upon by ICE. And I mean, it wasn't like a law. It was more like it was a memo that the department.
A gentleman's agreement.
Or as my friend, Joel Miller, he's a pastor in Mennonite Church in Ohio. Someone's in the sanctuary in his congregation. He called it, all we have is the DHS director sending the memo, which is a glorified email. Whole thing is based on a glorified email that the ICE agents won't trespass onto church property.
Yeah.
And that was the case, actually. They did not. And that is not the case this time around. So, you know, things are a little bit different. We also organized Ice Watch. I have a chapter in there on community defense. And I actually remember as I was titling that chapter, I was just like, ooh, this is... Basically, I was looking at the galley right before I went to press. And I'm like, I should have picked a better title. That sounds like way too intense. Community defense, I don't know. And so I, you know, talked about how we organized basically like ICE watch networks in our community so that when ICE showed up, we would have a bunch of people show up, and typically they don't like publicity. And so they would go away and all this kind of stuff. And now I'm realizing like community defense is actually what this is looking like now we need. I just saw that like the LA Dodgers just denied entry into their stadium for the ICE agents.
Yeah.
So even you got like the Dodgers engaged in some community defense out there.
Yeah, and then the ICE agents I saw first indicated they were on property but weren't there to detain people, and then came back and denied even being on property. So there's a whole kerfuffle there.
Yeah. But yeah, so that, I mean, those kinds of stories, I'm just like, this is what we did. We didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we kind of, so with like the community defense ICE watching, we actually borrowed, and at the same people were involved, and with the Black Lives Matter movement, BLM, around here, they organized what was called Cop Watch. Mm-hmm. And so same idea, like if you noticed, you typically a Black man being pulled over by the cops and being harassed, you all show up with your phones and you like pay attention. So it's that same kind of Cop Watch taken in terms of the direction of ICE. And it proved like pretty powerful. Like even the city and the county got behind us and were supportive, because we're learning now, like cities and counties, we love who we are. You know what I mean? Like we're a thriving community. Like we've built something together. And then all of a sudden an authoritarian president comes in and it's just like, hey, look, we're going to disrupt all that. And we're like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. So, this is where like all these people who talk theoretically about, church and state stuff, I'm like, you know, it's actually a lot more complicated, because if you're involved in local communities, like elected officials actually care what churches are doing to like create a stable community. Anyhow, that's a tangent.
Yeah. Well, Isaac, in your conclusion, you have this statement, and I'd love for you to unpack it a bit, because I think one of the things that the current administration, not just when it deals with immigration, but in lots of ways, is revealing what I would describe as a deficient or insufficient political theology to handle the moment, meaning who is the church and how do we relate to what we typically call politics? And you talk in your conclusion about how the phrase from the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come," is both a spiritual and a political longing. Mm-hmm. Most of our listeners come from like two different sort of default political theology camps. One is sort of they were raised in the culture war, take power by any means necessary. We're always under attack, kind of, focus on the family kind of political theology. And then others come from much more of a apolitical, stay out of politics because it's worldly and all politicians are evil and let's just focus on Jesus and spiritual things. But could you share maybe a vision for the political theology you're operating on, how thy kingdom come is both a spiritual and a political longing? How are those two things bound up together?
Yeah, first, amen to all politicians, like, are the worst, except for Bernie Sanders. I'm a Bernie bro through and through. Yeah. We could have just made that happen. Life would have been better for all of us. I actually don't even know. Political theology is just so complicated to me to think. I guess the way that I like to think about it is, I mean, I also grew up in a... I'm a church mutt. I grew up all over the place. Like, we were Catholic growing up and then evangelical, charismatic. And, but I, you know, like, I never quite was taught how words like the kingdom of God is a political word. Like, it's kingdom, you know, like it is a reality in the world, or that to say that Jesus is Lord, like, Lord is also a borrowed word from the political world and it means something about his authority in our lives. Mm-hmm. And how the church, the ecclesia, is also, that's a borrowed word for the way that local politics was organized in the first century. Ecclesia is like a called out people. It's like who you are together. It's about how you're formed together. And so, yeah, so I think we've really taken now, you know, becoming a pastor here and learning from my church about what it means to take seriously the fact that God has called us to be a people together. And what does it mean to be a people is like we care for each other's lives. We're bound together through mutual aid and care. And hopefully we embody forth this vision of, come Holy Spirit, transform our lives, that God's kingdom may draw near. That is something we do together with our lives. And it looks like, you know, bringing food for Rosa when she was at church. It looks like showing up for our neighbors when ICE is around the corner. It looks like all of that. So yeah, we just need to be real about that language and be involved with the care for our neighbor. Yeah, I mean, the other line that I like to think about in terms of this is, you know, Jesus saying, you know, this whole thing, this whole shebang is summed up in these two commands. They're both like related. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. And when he said, I mean, these are political things, to love your neighbor. That's how you build a politics. And when Jesus says that, love your neighbor as yourself, at least in my Bible, I haven't read the Trump Bible, but in my Bible, there's no footnote that says, hey, check their documentation status first, or like, you know, figure out where they are. It's just like, love your neighbor as yourself. And sometimes that puts us at odds with the governments of the world and their powers and how they dictate what life should be like. In the book, I also talk about how restriction of immigration and immigration policy has always been about the social engineering of a population, about who's allowed. This is a public law that affects our private lives because it determines our neighbors, who we fall in love with, who's in our schools, who's in our churches. And this country has a long legacy of prioritizing Euro-ethnic peoples. If we want to be about the universal church, that vision and revelation of all sorts of peoples and languages, it means that we have to be for our neighbors, a lot of them who are immigrants.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Let's get back to the show.
I think just as we close, I think the thing that is just being impressed upon me in our conversation is, I think sometimes, you know, like words like political theology, and I admire the people who do that work. I think it's important work, but I'm almost hearing what you're saying, like these things, when we actually do take the risk of getting to know our neighbors, of offering ourselves in solidarity to the actual people who are around us, right? All of these things get very, very clear, you know, in terms of just the morality of it and in terms of what, you know, needs to happen here. Like all the obfuscations, you know, theological obfuscations. Well, we don't want to get involved in politics. It's like, well, that's like saying, I don't want to get to know my neighbors, yeah, you know,
right.
Like that's the same thing as saying that. And once you get to know them, once you start to care about them, mm-hmm. once you begin to love your neighbor as yourself, well, you're practicing political theology and that all of these things get really clear. Mm-hmm. If you can take the risk of just getting to know your neighbors and deciding to love them.
Ben, I love that actually. This is where, yes, I want this. I want to put you on repeat on this because it's like the simplicity of what you just said, I think is what I want to emphasize as well. Yeah. Like people say, oh my gosh, immigration is so complicated. And like, I don't even know, how do you live in this world as people of faith? And so, and I'm just like, it's actually not complicated.
Right.
They want us to think it's complicated, yes. In order so that we don't do anything, but it's just so simple. Like, I mean, the story that comes to my mind right now, and again, an Arizona story, is Scott Walker, who is a Quaker, and this was during the first Trump administration. He would go out. He took seriously, you know, Matthew 25. It's like, look, if people are like thirsty, you give them water. It's not, you know, again, not very complicated. Our faith is so simple. It is simple, friends. And so he's out there. He's like, hey, Jesus says this, like, I'm going to go put out water in the desert for these people who are dying of dehydration, who are like trying to cross the border. Like, so he was involved in water drops. The Tucson Samaritans is what the organization is called. And then he gets prosecuted. A federal prosecutor takes him to court and says, look, you are violating, I can't remember what the U.S. code is, but the language is, you are harboring or providing material support for, their language, illegal aliens.
Yeah.
And it's a federal law he's breaking. Yeah. And they took him to court and he finally won because he's just like, he just kept on quoting the Bible. He's like, hey, look, Jesus said this. So I'm doing it. I'm just a guy out here living out my faith. And so he won his case on religious grounds. Like he can't infringe upon his faith, which is expressed through providing water for people who are thirsty. You know, the government doesn't want to. So it's that simple. But yeah, like that act, I guess, is political, of course, because you're violating a law. The law is really complicated, but the heart of the faith is quite clear.
Yes. And that none of us are actually in charge of writing policy. You know what I mean? Like none of our, there's like a few people who have to wrestle through the complex nature of immigration and, you know, like figure out all that out. But most of us don't. Most of us are just, we just need to love our neighbors and give water to thirsty people. That's all we got to do.
Yes. Again, amen. That is such a good point because it's, I think part of the obfuscation of what we're supposed to do is people in power making us think that they have the only power that counts.
Yes.
So the only power that counts is legislation, is lobbying, is whatever is going on in DC. And all of that is important. I mean, I'm not like, let's wash our hands out. No, you call the senator and say, hey, look, this is a bad bill like that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that's not the end of our witness. That's just like a small thing we could be doing, but we actually can do things with we have power. God has given us power, the power of the Holy Spirit, to get involved in our neighbors' lives, to creatively embody the gospel, to imagine new possibilities. And I think we get distracted from what worldly power is supposed to look like and not claiming our power that we have in Christ of caring for each other. So yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying.
Yeah. Mm.
The book, again, is called Migrant God, A Christian Vision for Immigrant Justice. Isaac, before we let you go, can you just tell listeners where they could maybe find your other work? I know you've written a lot, and where people can find you online.
I have a website. I really don't maintain it very well. I would say, I mean, yeah, if people are willing to buy that book, I would be just, that is just such a gift. I mean, like reading books in this world. Wow. Like what a, yeah. So if people want to buy that book, that's awesome. I write for the, I'm a columnist for the Christian Century. So you can find me in there every other month or so.
Yeah. Isaac, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Ben. This has been great. Thank you so much.
You know, what I came away from that conversation with Matt, do you know what it is? I'm going to tell you. You probably don't know what it is. It's only in my mind, and I've been meaning to tell you.
Okay.
But you can take a guess.
Is it a turtle soup recipe?
No, that's not it.
Okay, that would have been weird because we didn't talk about that at all.
Yeah, yeah. That. But so I was going to say good guess, but actually that was a bad guess. It was a really bad one. No, I've had, so one of the, you know, he talked a lot about organizing and getting to know your neighbors.
Yeah.
And I've been convicted that those are the same things. Like that's part of what it means to get organized is getting to know your neighbors. And creating, so I've had like one of the very simple things that people can do is to create like a network of mutual aid,
yeah.
They call it.
Yeah.
And I've been meaning to do that with just the people on my street, you know, maybe the people in my tiny little neighborhood. Just to like to I don't know how I would do it necessarily, but like create some kind of little sentence of vision for like why would we want to be connected as neighbors, and basically find people who are, you know, concerned about the same things we are, concerned about this authoritarian turn in our government, concerned mm-hmm. about ICE agents and, you know, like all of this stuff, like find people who are concerned about those things, and just connect us together.
Mm.
And then we can, you know, we find ways to, you know, whether it's like a group chat, or something like that, but find ways to be connected to each other, stay connected to each other so that I know what's going on in my neighbors' lives. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, cause right now, a lot of my neighbors, I just don't know who they are. I don't know their names. And so if they have a family member, for example, who's, you know, who's being harassed by ICE agents or something, I just won't know about it.
Right.
But I think I'd like to know about it because these are my neighbors. Yeah. So anyway, I came away from that interview thinking I've got to pull the trigger on that somehow. I don't know what that will look like or if it'll even work.
Aren't you?
But I've had it in my head.
Aren't you the president of your neighborhood association?
I'm not the president, but I am on the board.
I hear you're leading. You're leading a junta.
Well,
you're trying to gain. You're trying to gain control of the neighborhood association. That's the word on the street.
That's the word on the street. Yeah, obviously, it would have to be just my own organizing. I would not be acting on behalf of the board. So anyway, okay. but yeah, that's what I came away with. Matt is just like there are simple things that I know I can do in my neighborhood that I haven't tried yet. That I just need to try it.
Yeah, I'm. So once we hit stop on the recording, we spent another 20 minutes talking about like what's the end game right now in our world
with Isaac.
Yeah. With Isaac, yeah. We just chatted kind of off air, and I kind of wish we recorded it because I think that Ben, you shared some really helpful things, and Isaac's question was great. And, but I do think one of the features of our political economy, one of the things it produces and creates, is isolation.
Yes.
And the virtue of independentism, meaning meaning it's shameful to need people.
Yeah.
It's shameful to share problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It somehow is a reflection on your own insufficiency or deficiency mm-hmm. to let somebody know you in a way where they can help you.
Yeah.
And when we all know you should be able to help yourself.
Yeah.
Like all of this is baked into our culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't have to raise our hands and close our eyes to believe it. It just is part of our bones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so really what you're talking about, like, you know, when he talked about organizing, when he talked about loving neighbors, it legit is counterformation.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there's all kinds of, you know, I'm repenting live here because like I've known I should do this, you know, and I can do this, you know?
Yeah.
But there are all kinds of reasons that I come up with. It's going to be awkward. I'm not going to know what to say.
Yeah.
You know, some of my neighbors might not like it, you know, and then am I going to be a target of something? You know what I mean? Like there's all kinds of, and it's awkward and to get to know new people and to get to know people that, you know, you might not automatically jive with. It's not like you all joined the cool kids club. You just happen to live by each other.
Yeah.
And there's a cost to that. And so I think you're right. It's counterformational. I think it's one of the ways. I was struck by when we were talking with Isaac. It's one of the things that creates clarity for us is being with actual people in person, mm-hmm. like people that I actually live like on their porch, not watching a news report about immigration, not interacting with people on social media, not like things. I think one of the ways that the powers that be keep us isolated is through increasingly the only way we interact with the outside world is through our screens, is there's a mediation happening through the screen. And so I think there's something about being in person and getting to know people on the ground that yeah. feels increasingly important to me
yeah.
in these days.
Yeah.
So
I agree, man.
All right.
Well,
glad I got that off my chest.
Ben, what do you call a woman who sets her credit cards on fire? Bernadette.
I love that. Yeah, it's good. If only it were that simple.
Just burn the debt.
Yeah, yeah. Like after I use up all my debt, all the credit amount. I have on this credit card, just burn it and it's gone.
Can't take my house because I burned the credit cards.
I burned the credit card. That sounds like something one of the characters on Arrested Development would do.
Yeah.
Thinking they were being smart.
Probably Job.
Yeah, probably Job. Well,
all right, buddy.
Burned the credit cards. All right, y'all.
Till next time.
We'll see you next time. Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.